Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
La-di-da, la-di-da.
He's looking at you, kid.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday at the Movies. The summer movie season included more flops than an Olympic track meet. Can the film industry bounce back from one of its worst summers in 25 years? We'll talk about what's in theaters and what's on the way with Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Max Weiss of Baltimore Magazine. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick looks ahead to the new theater season. We'll see what's at the top of her must-see list. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're joining us for this edition of Midday at the Movies. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Tom, golly gosh darn, it's been a long time since you've given us a preview of your journal. What will you be writing in your journal tonight? Because, you know, it's like all of us, I journal. I mean, up until a few years ago, I didn't realize journal was a verb. But now I'm told that, like party, it is a verb. So tonight, dear diary, today... What a special show, because Max Weiss of Baltimore Magazine and Vulture.com has agreed to be with us for Midday at the Movies. So it's a Dear Diary day for me, and I'm sure it is for you. Max, welcome to the show.
Totally a Dear Diary day for me as well.
Exactly. Always good to see you.
Tom and Jed, thank you.
Always good to see you. And Jed Dietz, the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. As always, it's a pleasure to see you. Of course, I see you every month.
So not diary worthy.
Not quite diary worthy.
In the journal, not once has he mentioned the journal.
I mean, you're here the first Thursday of every month, and I appreciate it. I enjoy it. As a matter of fact, you've been here since, you know, the first Thursday in August. You've been sleeping under the table in the green room from what I'm told.
The entry is
him again. You just never. Yeah, that's right.
Yes. He's back.
Ditto last month. Yes, right. But it's always good to see you. We have a bunch to talk about. One of the things I want to talk about is there's a piece in the Post, and others have commented on this as well, that Hollywood has had its worst summer financially in 25 years. Right. So, Max, I mean, was that because there was a complete dearth of decent movies? Because I actually saw a few movies this summer that I thought were pretty good. So what am I missing here?
No, it was definitely not a dearth of good movies. If anything, perhaps the films were too good. You know, I mean, first of all, Wonder Woman did extremely well, and that was one of the best films of the summer, and certainly the best superhero movie I've seen in a while. But there were lots of small films that I really liked as well throughout the course of the summer, that the kind of films that you don't normally see throughout the summer, like The Beguiled, like Lucky Logan, like Baby Driver.
Big Sick, we talked a lot about Big Sick.
I love that movie. A movie I absolutely loved. But the big, what they call tentpole movies, with the exception of Wonder Woman, didn't do that well. So, like, for example, the Spider-Man film didn't do particularly well. Maybe they thought the Spider-Man was too young, or they were just sick of Spider-Man. They keep changing Spider-Man.
This is like Spider-Man 97 or
yeah, and he
right?
keeps getting younger. You know, it's like we keep getting older and Spider-Man keeps getting younger.
It's the movie. That's what movies are for.
Yeah. So, no, but it really, it's the opposite. It was not reflective of the quality of the films at all. So it's sort of an ironic thing. So it is a little puzzling, but I do think that there were too many actually high quality movies that maybe people weren't interested in seeking out.
Just to give it some perspective, the spring was way up compared to 2016. Mm-hmm. We're down basically two hit movies in the summer. You know, if we had Finding Dory and Captain America, which were in 2016, you'd have a blockbuster summer. Mm-hmm. If you just added those in. So it's a very delicate, I mean, even with this big a swing, which you're right, I mean, it's a 20 or 25 year, depending on how you count it, low point. But that, I think it does reflect movies. There was a thing in the New York Times today blaming Rotten Tomatoes, an aggregator of reviews, which I think is slightly crazy since Rotten Tomatoes was around in the spring, and the spring was very good.
Yeah. Right, right.
But I think there were some things that are tangible. The Game of Thrones kind of captured the attention of the American viewer. There was that big fight, that Conor McGregor, Floyd Mayweather fight that literally everybody was glued to. The fact that Netflix now, Amazon, Hulu are all introducing more original content so people can watch these things at home. These things are all factors, but ultimately I think that there's just these variables, but we could see next summer being an absolute blockbuster exactly. summer, and it's just silly to blame Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, blaming critics is just always the silliest.
No, well, I agree. It is interesting, though, the theater chains that are public companies, the value of their stock has gone down by $4 billion this summer. I mean, so it right now the perception is this, that theater going is over and whatever, you know, one of these apocalyptic things is being talked about, and it's all Rotten Tomatoes' fault or whoever you want to blame. And I just don't think that's true. I don't think we know enough yet. And I think.
But like any time period in any art form, there's highs and lows.
Yep.
You know, I mean, this is the summer that gave us a movie like Dunkirk, which I saw, which was a very powerful movie. I'm not sure I liked it, but it was so unsettling.
Yeah.
But it was a beautiful.
And especially
movie.
Great on a big screen, right?
Yes. I mean, and that's I saw it at IMAX and right. stuff, you know, it was unbelievable.
Right. And
but this, you know, the leading movie that week was the Emoji Movie. And, you know, and don't get me started on the Emoji Movie because I went crazy about it last month because it just drives me nuts that people are spending, you know, millions of dollars making a movie about the colony of emojis that live in your phone. Now, I'll be the first to admit, I never knew there was a colony of emojis living in my phone. I had no idea
until
I heard about this movie. But, you know, that was the number one movie for 2 or 3 weeks in the summer. And there were some really rotten movies, too, speaking of Rotten Tomatoes. And we talked last month, actually, Jed, about the fact that a lot of theater chains are including the Rotten Tomatoes reviews on their website.
And so Fandango.
Fandango.
You mentioned last time. Yeah.
So, you know, people are, you know, this is stuff that it used to be Rotten Tomatoes is something you had to go to, you had to look for. And now they're putting it in your face.
It's funny. I mean, the studio marketing people have for many, many years will tell you the reviews don't matter. They don't really care about that stuff. It's their marketing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they can trump all of those things. The art house movies, not so much. They need good reviews and PR and stuff. But I think, you know, once it turns bad a little bit, rather than looking to themselves and saying this movie maybe was a good concept, it didn't get developed well, or was a bad concept like Emoji Movie, you know, they start blaming other things. Mm-hmm. And it's always about the movies. People come out, it's like car sales, you know.
One thing with Rotten Tomatoes is it is an aggregator of reviews, and it's sort of blurs.
Yep.
Like, if you give a nuanced review that is negative but has some positive points, that's going to be stamped as a negative, as a splattered tomato. On the other hand, if you give a positive review that's not a rave, it's going to come as a happy tomato or whatever. And so, like, for example, a film that has 100% positive rating on Rotten Tomatoes, that just means that most critics liked it well enough. It doesn't mean it's a perfect film.
Right.
It doesn't mean that every critic. So I do feel that it's important for people.
So it's a pretty broad brush.
It's a very broad brush. And that is the biggest problem. You should be more nuanced in your approach to Rotten Tomatoes and realize what those numbers mean.
So, listeners, we'd love to hear what movies you loved this summer and which movies you didn't like. Now, the ground rules are you can't just say because it got a Rotten Tomatoes review, you have to actually have seen it. So if you want to admit, you know, in public that you saw the Emoji Movie, you are welcome to call 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So Game of Thrones, I actually saw the last episode of Game of Thrones. It was the first episode I've ever seen of Game of Thrones because I couldn't care less about Game of Thrones.
That's madness.
Sorry. But I thought it was just, you know, mildly amusing. I mean, it didn't move me one way or the other.
Do you think it's fair that you dropped in for the last episode
of
season 7?
I'm so out of it.
A proper assessor of Game of Thrones.
I am not, because I'm so out of it. When they said it was the final episode, I thought it was like the final episode forever.
Oh.
I thought, you know, so I thought this is going to be a cultural happening. It's like the last episode of MASH or something, which I also missed back in 1982. And I thought, well, we should watch this. I was visiting some friends, and Linnell and I were visiting friends in San Francisco, and we watched it. And none of us had ever seen Game of Thrones. So we all sat there. We saw these people, these dragons and things blowing up, and we thought, well, that's nice. And then we found out it's going to be back next season.
Right. Of course.
So that was
I think the key word is forever, actually.
Yeah.
It's funny. I actually wrote a blog about this, the way that I watch Game of Thrones. I watch it the way a child watches television or a sophisticated movie.
I host a radio program that way. Interesting.
I literally get about 20% of what's happening, and that's fine by me because that 20% is good enough to sustain my interest. But there are people who go deep into Game of Thrones, and they're watching it at a much higher 100% level, adult level. Right. I watch it like a child.
And I never want to sit next to those people on the bus. But HBO is following that up with a new series called The Deuce by our good friend David Simon, a former reporter for The Sun and author, and of course the progenitor of The Wire and Treme and stuff. So I saw about 20 minutes of it in a special preview that HBO has on the air now, and it starts officially on Sunday, the 10th. But this is a very powerful piece of work, isn't it?
It's an amazing piece of work. The eight of them are about to be put out on HBO. Interestingly, the first episode that I've seen, the pilot, is at the Toronto Film Festival as we speak. I think Saturday night they're doing a big event.
They're once more blurring the lines between film, TV,
and good. You know, and I think it's just, I mean, the writing, George Pelicanos is a writer with David Simon and creator of the show. No surprise to anybody who's been following his work. The writing is sensational. Maggie Gyllenhaal and James Franco are sort of the two anchors of the show. Fulcrums, I would say, rather than leads of the multiple storylines.
There's a lot of people in this piece. I mean, I only saw 20 minutes of it, and it's very gritty and powerful and upsetting. I mean, it's about the prostitution and the porn industry in the 1970s, back in the day when the New York Times when Times Square in New York wasn't Disneyland.
Right. That's you described it perfectly, and you see the impact on lots of people's lives. Interestingly, it came in as a concept with some controversy because it was these two men writing about a trade that's largely administered by women, not run by women, but administered by women. But Michelle McLaren, who is one of the creators of Breaking Bad, has directed the first and will direct the last episode, which I haven't seen. And it is sort of, I think, gotten through the controversy, and I think totally earned getting through that controversy. I think the Maggie Gyllenhaal character is a prostitute who chooses not to have a pimp, and there's a lot of discussion about what that means as a business proposition and as a personal safety proposition. And it's a totally fascinating world, but it is, you're exactly right, it's the Times Square you've almost forgotten about because it's way back in 1971, and it was really a very gritty place full of massage parlors, quote unquote, and B-run movie houses, some of them showing very salacious films, and you go right into that scene, and the movie is just beautifully done.
Yeah, it's powerful. So, Max, what do you think about that, the sort of creative license that, two men in this case have to write about prostitution? When David and George and others were writing about, the urban drug culture in The Wire, when Ishiguro, what's his name, writes a novel, a Japanese guy writes a novel about a British butler, The Remains of the Day. I mean, just, what sort of provenance is allowed these days?
I mean,
interesting that David did have a controversy about that.
I think that, first of all, David Simon has proven that he makes works that are really sensitive, that are they pay close attention to character. He clearly is somebody who listens to people. So I think that that's really important. If he talked to women and really listened to them and is invested in telling their stories, I mean, I give him the benefit of the doubt because of his body of work. Generally speaking, when I see something like that, I would love to see a woman more involved in terms of the creation, if it's going to be a female story. But with somebody,
and we should say, by the way, that Maggie Gyllenhaal is an executive producer.
Okay,
whatever that means.
And Michelle McLaren, as he mentioned. Mm-hmm. So, but again, I think that when you are somebody like David Simon, you have earned The credibility in this case that I believe you're going to tell these stories with empathy and sensitivity and nuance. And so, I'm really okay with. So I think I did do it on a case-by-case basis.
Let's listen to a little clip from The Deuce. This is the first episode.
All right. Let me run it.
Steady on it.
Straight, right?
This is Larry going to be a big night.
All right. Darlene, ain't no laying back tonight. You hear me?
Not for you, Daddy. You know I got a regular tonight.
I see this one in the tank.
Give me that, Barbara.
When I'm done, girl.
Larry Bragg will buy you girls a nice dinner in return. All right? Here with Loretta.
We got you, Daddy.
All right.
One of the things that struck me, and I only saw, as I said, for the first 20 minutes, is that there were like 300 people in every scene. It was unbelievable. I mean, you know, there's these principals. You talk about, you know, Franco, who actually plays two people. He plays twin brothers.
Right, exactly.
And then there's Maggie Gyllenhaal, but then there's a gazillion other people.
So yeah, so Kazan's in it. I mean, it's a wonderful cast.
How is Franco? Because I'm always mixed on him. He's delivered some fantastic performances, and then he's delivered some performances where I find him very kind of flat. He just doesn't pop. So how is he here?
I think he's fantastic. Oh, I think it's the best thing he's done since Spring Breakers.
Spring Breakers. Yeah. I loved him in that.
And yet, a much less spectacular character than he played in Spring Breakers. And he, as Tom said, he plays these twin brothers who are two sides of the coin. And he does it really seamlessly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took me a little while to even – I knew the credit. I mean, I knew he played both these roles. But it was a bit into the first scene with the two brothers before it dawned on me. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Well, cool.
Speaking of Spring Breakers, we're going to take a little break right now. And during that break, I'll ask you what Spring Breakers is because I have no idea. And before we take that break, by the way, I want to take a look ahead to next month. On Tuesday, October 10th, we're going to broadcast Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry. We're going to be talking about the deindustrialization of Baltimore and the future of work. Tickets to that event, we hope you'll join us, are free, and they're on our website, wypr.org/midday. When you come there, we'll have a link to the BMI website so you can reserve a seat. So that's Midday live from the Baltimore Museum of Industry on Tuesday, October 10th, very similar to the live broadcast we did from the SNF Parkway Theater last spring. Max Weiss and Jed Dietz are here. We're talking movies. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR, where you're tuned to Midday.
And welcome back. It's Midday at the Movies. By the way, coming up tomorrow, Senator Ben Cardin will be my guest here in Studio A. He's the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Talk about North Korea, the DACA decision, the apparent agreement to raise the debt ceiling, at least for 3 months, tax reform and other issues that are on the very, very full legislative plate that faces Congress these days. Plus, we'll hear an in-studio performance by a terrific singer-songwriter named Andrea Carlson. She's appearing at Germano's Piattini this weekend, and she'll give us a taste of her set tomorrow on Midday. So I hope you can join us. And coming up later today, theater critic J. Wynn Russick gives us her annual preview of the new theater season. But now we're going to continue talking movies with Max Weiss of Baltimore Magazine and Vulture.com. That's the entertainment website of New York Magazine. And Jed Dietz, he's the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. Did you have a favorite summer movie? Did you have a dog that you happened to see that you didn't like? And I'm not talking about a pet. I'm talking about a dog of a movie. Give us a call and let us know. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Kyle and Havre de Grace, welcome to Midday with Jed Dietz and Max Weiss.
Thank you so much for the call. I love this topic of my wife and I always go over what dud movies did we waste our money on this summer. But to your question as to the favorite movie, I thought of one initially and have another one to add. But I was really surprised. I really enjoyed Get Out. I was shocked by, I was so intrigued by the idea of Peele from Key and Peele putting something together that was being, pushed as like a suspense, that I kind of went in with very low expectations, despite it was also one of those byproducts of crazy Rotten Tomato. I think it held some record for holding 100% for so long. But despite that, I think I went to like a matinee And I went on and told folks, go see it. It was that good. I enjoyed it that much.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a sort of a sleeper movie. No one expected it. It's a horror movie. No, that's a real genre niche thing, Jed. And it did really, really well.
Yeah, horror and comedy. So sort of a funny mashup, too. Yeah, complete surprise. And a terrific movie that I think also has a lot to say culturally.
Yeah. Let's talk about Logan Lucky. That's at the Senator Theater. Max, you mentioned this is a Steven Soderbergh movie. It's got Channing Tatum and Adam Driver, Daniel Craig, big cast. It's about these two sort of hapless brother types. I mean, what's it about? What do they do?
Yeah, it's a heist movie, basically. They're going to try to steal a lot of money from a big racetrack. But it's... The thing with Soderbergh is that, you know, he did Ocean's 11, so he can do these heist movies in his sleep, and he makes them seem so effortless, all these twists and turns and misdirections, and this one sort of blends what he was doing with Ocean's 11 with almost more of a Coen Brothers-type sensibility, a kind of dark comedy, and it's hilariously funny, but it also just works incredibly well as a heist film, and one of the things is that you kind of underestimate the characters. You underestimate Channing Tatum and his brother, played by Adam Driver. And there's a fantastic role for Daniel Craig doing comedy, which I have never seen him do. You know, I'm used to seeing him as
James
Bond.
James Bond, for gosh sake.
And he is so funny and having so much fun. It just works. It's such a pleasure to watch Soderbergh work because he's such a master of the form and he just makes it look effortless. So that's if good. You like heist films, this is the one.
Here's a little clip. Logan Lucky.
But a place like the track, it's gonna have 20 times the security of a bank. So that's negative. But there'll be a whole mess of people walking around there, and that's positive. Helps us blend in. There'll be metal detectors and cameras and, you know, recording every inch of the place. That's negative. We can't bring anything through them gates. No explosives. Guns.
No, we don't want to use any guns.
Absolutely no guns.
Well, I guess then, for you Logans, that's a positive.
Oh, that's just silly. So, I mean, you know, Jen, when you're applying for a job, you know, your spouse or your mother or your father or your uncle may say, well, make a list, the positives and the negatives, you know. would it be a good thing if you, you know, moved to Timbuktu to take a job with Boeing, you know. I mean, so, but they seem to pull this off, these guys.
Yeah, and I just to underscore what Max said, I mean, Soderbergh's career is really one of the most interesting careers because he's worked in very, very big movies with huge budgets and, you know, nobody worries about a review. It's all about the marketing. And he's worked very small. He's executive produced movies we've had at the festival with, you know, emerging filmmakers. I mean, he's really, it's an incredible career. And he had retired, quote unquote, from movie making a little while back, which I assumed he was going to do something exciting, and he's back making movies, which I'm thrilled by.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones to hear a little bit about hits and flops. Adrian in York, Pennsylvania, welcome to Midday. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, sir. I'd like to talk about the movie Baby Driver, which I thought was very original. Jamie Foxx in it, a lot of stars. I've got the guy's name who was the head of the...
Is it Kevin
like
Spacey?
Ansel Elgort is the baby driver.
Oh, yeah. Ansel Elgort.
And Kevin Spacey is
in the movie. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
That's a good suggestion, Adrian. A lot of folks really like that movie. And Jed, we've talked about this, the interesting construct of that movie, because it's sort of created around a playlist.
Yeah. So this director, Edgar Wright, I mean, literally choreographed this movie. I mean, it's a heist movie. It's another heist movie. But literally is... The whole rhythm of the movie is built around this playlist on this kid, Baby Driver's.
Now, how did it do at the box office?
Did very well.
Very well.
It was another one that was sort of seen as, despite that great cast, seen as sort of a smaller movie shot and only
so
a few
when,
days.
So when we talk about the flops, they're talking about these expectations for these huge movies. They wanted Spider-Man to make, you know, a gazillion dollars, and it only made $1 billion.
Baby Driver was a revelation in a way. The fact that it made as much as it did.
And
it's not associated with a comic book character or any sort of franchise. It was a completely independent film, and those kinds of films don't usually make the kind of money that Baby Driver made. So that was one of the true bright spots of the summer. And I also really enjoyed the heck out of that film.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I gotta catch it. Roscoe in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Max Weiss and Jed Dietz.
Yeah, I just want to say good afternoon to you and your guests. I went and saw the Planet of the Apes movie, which I've been following that whole line since its inception, mm-hmm. back from Charlton Heston. And I want to say I was really, really disappointed at this latest version. I mean, it was so slow. It was a dearth of, it wasn't much action during the course of the movie. And Woody Harrelson brought nothing. His character, he brought nothing to the movie. And then the straw that broke the camel's back for me is that the writers, I mean, how they incorporated, you know, the old Jewish story about Moses not getting to the promised land. I mean, you know, lack of creativity. I mean, the movie really, really disappointed me.
Well, thanks for the call, Roscoe. Now, that's interesting because here's a guy who's been following this franchise for a long time. Charlton Heston. I mean, this is, you know, what's that, 70s, the first
original,
one, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and if you're disappointing him because he's a viewer that's going to go into the theater really wanting to like this movie, and they swung and missed.
No, it's interesting. I mean, because this got great critical response. But I do think a franchise, as it develops, is a very hard thing to manage. And we've seen some great successes. Harry Potter, I would put at the top of the list. But it's very, very hard to keep it fresh and also honor the expectations of early adapters who cherish the early versions of the movie.
The thing with, I didn't see the most recent one, but the early ones in the 70s, they were campy. They were tongue-in-cheek. These are serious. They're kind of important. They take themselves very seriously. And that's one of the reasons why I've avoided them. I mean, I just think that when you've got a movie about a planet of apes and you've got, you know, Woody Harrelson as some sort of crazed general, it's just, if you can't laugh at yourself, then maybe you shouldn't be making them. But Jed is right. It has gotten critical raves. It never really called out to me.
Well, you know, instead of apes. They had the option here, and they decided not to do it. But instead of apes, it could have been emojis. It could have been. I'm just saying.
Tom is obsessed.
It's a creative decision that they decided not to make.
Our loss.
I want to listen to a little clip from a movie called Ingrid Goes West. Oh. This intrigued me when I saw the trailer, and so I want to hear what you guys think about it.
A couple of ground rules, okay?
Okay.
I need you to tell everyone that you're my boyfriend. It's a long story, but I just need you to say that.
No, I get
everyone.
It. I see that you dig me. I dig you. I'll be your boyfriend.
Okay.
I'll be your boyfriend.
Okay, whatever. And also, no Batman talk.
What am I supposed to talk about? I don't know these people.
Something cool, like food or clothes or Joan Didion.
Okay.
Talk about comic books or anything. Oh. These people don't care about stuff like that.
Anything else you might just
Yes. Say? Whatever you do, just stay away from Nikki.
Who's Nikki?
Nikki is Taylor's brother, and he's a f***ing liar and a drug addict, and he's just not to be trusted, okay?
Oh, God! What's up?
Hey!
Who's that?
This is Dan Pinto, my imaginary boyfriend.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow our guest is Ben Cardin, and we're going to talk about food, clothes, and Joan Didion. So this is another film that's at the Senator Theater. How's it go, Jed? What do you think? That seems cute to me, and I like this actor, Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, she's wonderful. And it is cute. I would say maybe not as giving it as much of a lift as in that word as you were giving it, but I think she's terrific. Elizabeth Olsen plays this meme person who's become sort of a social media darling, and Aubrey Plaza's character is desperate to see her, Ingrid, and she goes west to basically insert herself into her life. Elizabeth Olsen is also in Wind River, playing an FBI agent, very different role. It's terrific. Aubrey's terrific. I thought the movie was a little slight.
I liked it better than Jed. I think it has so much to say about social media and how we invent these perfect lives. We construct and curate this idea of a perfect life on Instagram. And the Ingrid character is somebody who sees somebody else's perfect life, and she buys into it hook, line, and sinker. So she travels west to try to sort of ingratiate herself into this person's life. And I think it just really, it's a very sharp social satire. I think the acting was great, and it really gets this weird way that we're all living our lives on social media right now. And the guy you heard in that clip is O'Shea Jackson, who is Ice Cube's son, who looks just like him, and who is so delightful
he's
and
great.
Charming.
Yeah.
So he's also worth mentioning. Yeah, so I liked it a little more than Jed did.
All right, Ingrid Groswest is at the Senator Theater. We got a call from a woman who couldn't stay on the line. She wants to talk about The Deuce. She says she's disturbed by it and its portrayal of sex workers. And I can understand this. I mean, having not seen the whole thing, it is a very disturbing scene. She notes that a much better vehicle for portrayal of women on HBO is Big Little Lies.
Loved
Have you guys
it.
Seen that?
Huh? Oh, did you see that, Jen?
Yeah.
I adored it.
And I think it's very good, too. Very, very different. I mean, I think this, and both worthy, but I think... The view of sex in this world is the view of sex as commerce. There's not too much relationship stuff going on. This is about, and I think it's a rare thing that really focuses on that. You see different women, different personalities, different pimps, different personalities, and I think it's You really, I don't want to kill it by saying you learn something because that sounds like it's not entertaining. It's highly entertaining. But I think it's important because of that.
Mm-hmm. How about Beach Rats? That's at the Charles Theater. Max, you saw that?
Yeah, I loved it. This is by a director named Eliza Hittman who comes to the Maryland Film Festival every year.
Yeah, she's been here with both movies, yeah.
And she does these films. She herself is from the Brooklyn area, and she does these films about not the sort of hipster Brooklyn, but the more the poorer side of Brooklyn. And this is about a young gay male sort of coming to terms with his sexuality while hanging out with his bros over the summer. And I think she just captures teenage ennui in such an affecting way, and you follow his journey. The young actor is named Harris Dickinson, and I found out after the film that he's British, and yeah. I was stunned. He is so convincing as this Brooklyn kid. He's remarkable. He's extremely handsome for the ladies. But I just think the film is sensitive and beautiful, and I think Eliza Hittman is really a filmmaker to watch. I think she's very special.
Was this movie at the festival?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And we've had two of her films, and she's been in town to meet with film students here. I totally agree with Max. I mean, this is a very important talent in the film world. And Beach Rats is an incredible movie. There's a lot of mystery to the sexuality, and it really is about teenage uncertainty. I mean, that moment is this coming of age thing is sort of a trope in the movie world, but it's sort of fun and easy or catastrophic. This is like different than that. This is this young guy really trying to find his way through the maze, and it's beautifully done. And this actor, I heard him at the Q&A at Sundance, I could not believe, I thought he was acting. He was doing this British accent. I thought he's being funny. And no, he's from England.
Yeah, I think he's a rising star. Yeah. I really do.
All right, so Beach Rats, that's at the Charles Theater here in Baltimore. I want to talk to you, Jed, about a very unique opportunity for film buffs at the Parkway Theater, the SNF Parkway, which has been the home of the Maryland Film Festival for now like 4 months or so.
Right.
Titicut Follies. Yeah. It's a one-night-only presentation on the 24th of September, so in a couple of weeks. And this is some sort of restored print of a very important movie?
Yeah, Frederick Wiseman is one of the most important documentary filmmakers working. He's in his 80s now. He was a lawyer by training, totally self-taught. He's the archetype of cinema verite. So there's no graphics, there's no questions being asked. He literally points his camera at whatever his subject is. And then edits it. This was his first film. It was made, the Attorney General of Massachusetts overruled the guy who ran the mental institution that he wanted to get into film. The Attorney General at the time was Elliot Richardson, then went on to great fame in the Nixon administration.
Right, the Watergate fame.
Yeah, indeed. Mm-hmm. And who hated the movie when it came out. So this movie was then banned for 10 years. You couldn't see it. It's now been fully restored. It's rarely been seen. It's a phenomenal piece of documentary filmmaking. And we'll have it for one day.
Banned in Boston, for real.
Banned around everywhere.
Not just Boston.
Actually.
Yeah. right. Interesting. All right. So that's on the 24th of September. Max, I want to talk to you about a movie called Home Again.
Yes.
With Reese Witherspoon. She's a single mom in L.A., and she allows these three young guys to
Hunks.
Move in with her.
Yeah.
I'm interested in this because I just saw, because I'm behind the times and everything, I saw 20th Century Women.
Which is
ago.
Amazing.
I love that movie.
This
and
is
it's
no...
about a mom with a son who has these two or three girls that are helping her with him. So I was interested in the sort of parallels of the premise, at least.
And she's producing now. I mean, that's.
Yeah.
What...
I love Reese Witherspoon. She was so brilliant in Big Little Lies on HBO, and she is a brilliant actress. And I wanted to like this movie so much. It's actually directed by Hallie Myers Shire, who is the daughter of Nancy Myers.
And Charles Shire.
Right, yeah. Exactly. You know, famous for What Women Want and Baby Boom and, you know, movies like that. Famous for what they call her kitchen porn, because she always does
beautiful
these
kitchens,
films
right.
and beautiful
There's a
houses.
Genre called kitchen
oh,
porn?
It's Nancy Myers, kitchen porn.
What,
anyway.
What is this show devolving into? We're talking about, you know, the 1971 sex trade in New York, and now we're talking about kitchen porn in L.A.?
Wait till you hear about emoji porn, then you're really going to...
No, please,
I made that up. It doesn't exist. Anyway, I wanted to like this because...
By the way, emojis don't exist either.
Right.
Just saying.
Okay, all right, good.
Just,
fair
little,
point.
Little point here.
Yeah. You know, there used to be these sort of mid-budget films that were directed towards women that starred people like Meg Ryan, you know, and Diane Keaton. And I sort of longed for those halcyon days, and I really wanted this to be one of those films. But it's just not that good, you know? I mean, once it was over, I didn't really understand what kind of journey the Reese Witherspoon character... Yes, she split from her husband. She's moved to California. These three young studs move in with her. And then the final scene, this is not really a spoiler per se, is like a dinner where she's sitting around a table with the three studs and her ex-husband, and it's this extended family. And I'm like, what did I just see? Like, what was the point of this? And it's a film that flattens Reese Witherspoon, which is pretty hard to do because as an actress,
she's
so great. And this, she could be any actress in this. So it was so disappointing.
Well, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So that's Home again.
Yeah.
Marjorie Prime is a movie. We're just got to finish up here now, Jed. That's at the Parkway. This is a brand new movie, right?
Yeah, Coming to the Parkway. And it's a play originally. Filmed with an incredible cast. John Hamm's in it. Lois Smith plays the central character who played it on stage in two different productions. Gina Davis is in it, who hasn't made a movie in a while. Tim Robinson, it's really terrific.
So big time
it's
cast.
Opening. Yeah.
Well, that's going to be fun.
Oh, it will
be. I want to mention one more, and this is Patty Cakes, which is a new one by Jeremy Jasper. That's at the Charles Theater. Have you seen that one?
I have
seen it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I saw it at Sundance, and we tried to get it for the festival. It's a story about a heavy girl, late teens, early 20s, who lives in a small town in New Jersey and is bullied. And she loves rap and she is good at it. And that, of course, increases the amount of bullying that comes her way. And she rides her love. And it's a wonderful story, sort of with rocky tones set in New Jersey.
All right. Well, we are out of time. Max, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much for filling in for Ann Hornaday.
Thank
we
you
very
for
much
having
appreciate
me.
It. We will
I enjoyed
see you
it.
Again sometime. And Jed, always a pleasure, sir.
Always.
And we'll see you next month. Max Weiss is the managing editor and film critic of Baltimore Magazine. She also writes at Vulture.com. That's the entertainment website of New York Magazine. You can find her film reviews at the Max Space page on BaltimoreMagazine.net. Jed Dietz, of course, is the founder and director of the Maryland Film Festival. One other mention about what they're doing. The festival is presenting the first ever Latin American Visionary Cinema Series. It's going to celebrate National Hispanic Heritage Month. It kicks off a week from Saturday at the SNF Parkway. And we've got a link to details on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a quick break, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick takes a look down the road at what's on tap in local theaters this season. You're listening to Midday. I'm really happy and grateful about that. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.